This is a benefit for KKFI, but I also want to thank the co-sponsor organizations who have helped promote this event and have tables out there. And they are Military Families Speak Out, Kansas City Veterans for Peace, Kansas City Our Revolution, Citizens for Justice in the Middle East, Jewish Voice for Peace, KC, Peaceworks Kansas City, and Friends of Community Media. And thank you all for your help. So Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of the women-led peace group called Code Pink. How many of you ever heard of Code Pink? How many of you are wearing pink? Okay. Well, they wear pink all the time, and usually you see them in the halls of Congress wearing pink. She is also a co-founder of an organization that meant a lot in my life, Global Exchange, which is a human rights organization based in San Francisco, which has for years been fighting for human rights all over, particularly in Latin America. That's how I know them from the work I've done there, and have made a big difference in terms of being able to impact corporate behavior in offshore plants that produce things like the pink that you're wearing or not. Anyway, Medea has been an advocate for social justice for more than 40 years. She must be old. She doesn't look it, though. I just finished reading her second to the last book, which is her book on Saudi Arabia called Kingdom of the Unjust, aptly titled. Oh, my God. It's quite a read, and we've got a bunch of them out there and back, so I highly recommend it. I haven't read her book on Iran, which is her latest book, but people I've talked to who have say it is just chock full of information that you never knew that you need to know, especially about one of the premier candidates that we're about to go to war with, I guess. So read up. Anyway, she's a prolific writer. She has articles, frequent articles in The Guardian, Huffington Post, Common Dreams, Alternet, and The Hill. But the thing I think Medea is best known for these days is her courage in standing up and speaking truth to power. And I don't know how many of you saw the video. Our Revolution posted it on their Facebook page of the demonstration just this week during the hearings with Elliot Abrams, a certified war criminal, where a number of members of Code Pink interrupted the hearing three different times and got arrested. And you can ask her what happens to people when they get arrested. It's kind of interesting. And of course, in the video, I saw Medea there videotaping the whole thing, you know. It's so important to speak out because nobody is speaking out on Venezuela right now. You know, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans. A few stray Democrats, but not the leadership. And it is so important, the work that they're doing. So, with great pleasure, I welcome Medea Benjamin.
Well, it's wonderful to be here, and it was so exciting to see all of your tables out there with such great organizations and work that so many of you are doing. I must say that I'm a bit of a coastal snob, having born in New York, then gone to San Francisco, and then moved to Washington, D.C. But I get really inspired when I'm not in a coast and I find that people are doing really fantastic work, and it's often in much harder circumstances. So I really want to thank you for those of you who are doing this, some of you newer to it, and some of you doing it for a long lifetime. And I've met a couple of you in many circumstances over the years, including, where's Don? Where did Don go? Doing work around Central America decades ago. And here we are almost full circle in terms of U.S. involvement in Latin America. You know, during the time that the U.S. was and is still involved in perpetual wars in the Middle East, we used to say there was one silver lining, and that was they were too busy to look over at Latin America. And during that time, you had the pink tide with all of these countries in Latin America getting progressive governments, doing amazing things to eliminate poverty. I mean, Brazil under Lula is incredible. And in Argentina, in Bolivia, in Uruguay, in Ecuador, and Venezuela, and having this real solidarity among Latin American countries. I was one of the U.S. representatives to a, there was a economic coalition put together of the progressive governments in Latin America called ALBA, which means dawn. And through that, it was the whole idea was, how are we going to lift up the countries in Latin America that were the poorest? How could we help them? By giving them maybe some subsidized oil, by doing helping with their agriculture, you know, all kinds of solidarity kinds of things. And that, unfortunately, has really fallen apart now that so many of the countries in Latin America have been taken over by conservative governments, right-wing governments, even bordering on fascist governments. And in the meantime, the country of Venezuela really being under siege right now. And I don't want to get into Venezuela too much, but I think it's important to say that this is a playbook that we have seen over and over and over. You take one leader of a country, pretend he's the only one that's governing that country, and demonize him so much to turn him into the devil incarnate, and then that justifies whatever you want to do to destroy that country even more. And I'm not an apologist for Maduro. I know they've made lots of mistakes in Venezuela, particularly around economic issues. I also know that during his time, the price of oil just tanked. And to recognize there's a lot of internal sabotage that's been going on ever since the time Hugo Chavez came to power and really wanted to transform the government and to give this kind of solidarity to the rest of Latin America. And then you add on that the economic sanctions that as of 2017 have been so, so crippling that you get a real crisis situation, and then the U.S. steps in as if it is the savior in that crisis that it helped to create. And that's where the situation is today. And I think, Judy, with your introduction, talking about in many of these things, the Democrats not being much better than the Republicans, and certainly Venezuela is an example of that. I used to live for a long time in San Francisco, and Nancy Pelosi was my representative. And, you know, she's very sharp cookie in a lot of things. She's really been able to do things like help to take back the House in the Congress, which is really important. But when I saw her the other day standing with the representatives of the parallel government that the Trump administration has put in place in Venezuela, I think that does not represent the interests of her constituents in San Francisco. I think she'd be hard-pressed to find anybody in San Francisco who would say that setting up a parallel government and putting somebody as president who's never been elected by one person in Venezuela to be president is somehow part of a democratic transition. So, Judy also mentioned the hearing that just took place in Congress. And those of you who do remember the dirty deeds of Elliot Abrams, you could just think about how horrific it was to see that man walk into the Congress and be seated as a witness and treated by most of the people, not all of them, most of the congressional people, as if he had something to teach us that would be beneficial for U.S. national interests and for the interests of the people in Venezuela. When somebody like him acts as if he cares about the people of Venezuela, you know, let's be clear, Elliot Abrams does not give a damn about the well-being of the people of Venezuela. He gives a damn about Venezuela's oil, and that is about it. and he wants to be part of the regime change. And he is somebody that has done this before. So in that sense, the Trump administration brought in somebody who was indeed well-placed to engineer this coup. But we are seeing a coup taking place right now. And instead of reading about it in the history books 10 or 20 years from now, and seeing how a people in Venezuela already suffering from an economic crisis was made worse by a coup, let's see what we can do to stop that from happening. So I have been working for, moved to Washington, D.C., about 12 years ago from San Francisco, because I really wanted to be where in the very belly of the beast. And some of you might not know what Code Pink is. We started after the 9/11 attacks with this idea that the 9/11 attack was horrendous. Our job was to find who attacked us and bring them to justice, not use it as an excuse for those who wanted to invade and topple other governments that had nothing to do with 9/11. And you might have remembered the color-coded alerts of the Bush administration, the stupid yellow, orange, red kind of thing. So ours was a response to that, the Code Pink. It was going to be Code Hot Pink until we found that was a porn site, so we couldn't do that. But it was to be acting as a short-term organization that we didn't even want to be an organization. We'd just come together and join the growing uprising around the United States to say no to the U.S. using it as an excuse to invade other countries. And, you know, we did our job as citizens. How many of you participated in some anti-Iraq war demonstration? So most hands are going up in this room, and some are maybe too young to have done it. We did our job as citizens, and unfortunately, at that time, the Bush administration called us a focus group and went ahead and ignored the focus group and did the invasion of Afghanistan, then the invasion of Iraq. And here we are now, over 17 years later, with troops still in Afghanistan. We have military families speak out here, and thank you for the wonderful work of that organization and Veterans for Peace and the other groups who all of these years have said, we shouldn't have gotten involved in these wars to begin with, and let's get out of them. And it does pain me. Yes, let's. And I am here certainly not to defend the Trump administration, but let me say there are certain times that a broken clock is right, and that is around Afghanistan and Syria to bring the troops out of there, to bring them back home. And we should not allow the Democrats to stop that from happening. There's another one in which the clock is right. Maybe this is the third time, the broken clock, and that is around Korea. It is actually a very positive thing that the Trump himself has met with Kim Jong-un. I've been to North Korea. It's a country that desperately needs to be opened up and part of, brought back into the fold of the world, and to end the war there that has never been over since 1950s. The longest, I mean, talk about really the longest war. It's not Afghanistan, it's Korea, because that war never ended. And so to have Trump reaching out, and there's going to be a second summit coming up very soon in Vietnam now between Kim Jong-un, the chairman of North Korea, and Donald Trump. And already we hear the clamoring coming mostly from the Democrats, the naysaying. We even have pieces of legislation that they are introducing, and these are liberal Democrats saying things like, one piece of legislation says that Donald Trump is not authorized to withdraw any troops from South Korea. That is crazy. They've been there since the 50s. Don't you think it's time to withdraw those troops from South Korea? Especially if the South Korean government wants those troops withdrawn? And yet there are Democrats that are saying, no, we demand those troops stay there. There's other Democrats who have another bill that is saying one of the only concessions that the U.S. government has made so far to North Korea, you know, it hasn't let up on very crippling economic sanctions, is to say that we will suspend the military exercises that we do with South Korea because they are seen as threatening to North Korea. They're called exercises like decapitation of the North Korean leadership. They're as exercises with what would happen with unleashing nuclear weapons in North Korea. So the North Koreans have rightly suggested that while we are in a process of negotiation, it might be nice not to have these, quote, war games going on, and Trump has suspended them. And so there are Democrats that are coming back and saying, no, we want those military exercises to proceed. And this is all to kind of trip up the negotiations. And it's important for us to recognize that we have to love peace more than we dislike Donald Trump. And that when he happens to be doing something that is actually good for world peace, let's work with him on that. Let's push him on that. But in general, Donald Trump is no peacemaker. So let's go to some of the things that are really bad happening right now with this Trump administration. And one of them is the way that Donald Trump has embraced even more closely this relationship with Saudi Arabia. Now, this is a relationship that has gone on with Democrat and Republican administrations since the time of, the founding of Saudi Arabia was in 1932. In 1938, they discovered oil. So it was really since the time of the discovery of oil, and then especially during World War II, when the U.S. realized that it needed the oil from Saudi Arabia and made a pact with Saudi Arabia that we will protect your kingdom as long as you keep selling us oil. And this pact has gone on for decades. Even today, where the U.S. does not need Saudi Arabian oil, thanks to things like fracking, unfortunately, the U.S. continues to be a close ally and protector of Saudi Arabia. And let's look for a minute what it is that we are helping to protect. This is an absolute monarchy that has never tried to even pretend to have elections. I mean, here we are saying that Venezuela's elections aren't free and fair, and yet our great buddies in Saudi Arabia don't even bother to have elections, where the leadership is passed on from king to prince to crown prince right now. And a country where there is tremendous internal repression against the minority Shia community, against the entire gender of women, against anybody who is a dissident. There's no free speech, no freedom of elections, no freedom of assembly. And where there has been an effort on the part of PR firms who are handsomely paid by the Saudi government, and many of them are in the town that I now live in, Washington, D.C., to pretend that Saudi Arabia is evolving and that it's part of this reform because they have this young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, whose dad, who is no longer like totally there mentally, has basically passed over the reins to this crown prince, who is now, I think, just 33 years old, but he was given the power when he was 30 years old. And there was a tremendous PR campaign to say the kingdom is changing because now they have this new, young, vigorous, visionary crown prince. And he came to the United States, it was just a little over a year ago, and traveled around and met with all of the notables in Washington, D.C. Then he went to MIT and Harvard, where he was feted at the elite universities. Then he went and met with Bill Gates, and he went to Silicon Valley and met with all the high-tech companies. He met with Oprah Winfrey. Everybody acting like this was a leader of a country that was somehow evolving into an open society. And in the meantime, he was cracking down back home. And it only came to light with the death of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was brutally, barbarically murdered in the Turkish consulate, in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, and then literally chopped up with a bone saw, And we can only speculate now that his remains were melted down in some kind of acid, because we have no idea where those remains are. And it was only then, because he was a well-known writer for an elite paper like the Washington Post, that people started paying attention and saying, well, maybe this crown prince is not all that he is cracked up to be. In the meantime, it is the crown prince himself, Mohammed bin Salman, who started the Saudi involvement in the war in Yemen. Now, you have probably, if you've paid any attention to international news and anything about Yemen, you've probably heard it over and over again that Yemen is the most catastrophic situation, humanitarian crisis in the world today. But it is barely covered by the national media. And the few times that it is covered, people really don't get a sense of what's going on there. And it's so important, because our hands are so bloodied with that war, because of the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia that was once based on oil, but over the years turned into a relationship of them buying our weapons, buying over $100 billion of our weapons, with U.S. companies like Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Boeing and all of these companies seen as great patriots. They are the ones that are making billions of dollars by selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And what is Saudi Arabia doing with those weapons? They are using it daily to bomb the people of Yemen. And it was already a poor country, because Yemen didn't have oil. But now it is just a horrendous situation, where every 10 minutes there is a Yemeni child dying from the effects of this war and the hunger that is created because of the destruction of the infrastructure. I used to work as a nutritionist. That was my job. I used to work for the United Nations. And my job was in Africa, to work in rehabilitation centers with kids who were coming in basically so dehydrated that we had most of the time we were unable to bring them back to life, and they would just die in our arms. And I decided I couldn't keep working on that I had to deal with the political issues of why is that happening. And in the case of Yemen, it is absolutely human-made. It's a human-made disaster. It is a disaster where our companies are making so much money from the death and destruction and the killing of innocent Yemeni children. I just read an article as I was sitting back there talking about how the Israelis are making so much profit over the war in Yemen, that they too are selling weapons under the table to their enemy, the Saudis, who are now really their friends, and they are sending mercenaries there, and they're doing all kinds of things to make money, as the U.S. is doing, and as all the Western democracies are doing off of this war in Yemen. It is big business. War is big business. And who suffers most, of course, is the children. And if you see any pictures of these Yemeni children, if you don't weep, it's because you have a heart of stone, because they've lost their mass, their body mass. It is skin and bones, literally. And this is what is happening before our eyes. And there are at least some people in Congress who have taken this up as an issue, and I want to pay tribute to them. People like Chris Murphy in the Senate, who has said the blood of the Yemeni children is on our hands. He said it like it is. And Bernie Sanders, who has taken it up in the Senate as well. And people like congressmen from the Silicon Valley, Ro Khanna from California, who knew he would be such a great proponent of peace. And they introduced a very unique way of getting at the issue of U.S. support for the war in Yemen, not only selling the weapons, but giving the logistical support. Actually, we have, until recently, we were refueling their airplanes in the air, which only means that those planes didn't have to come down to keep bombing. They could just stay up and keep bombing. And giving the logistics mean we were telling them what targets. And supposedly we were telling them what not to target, like schools and hospitals and things like that. And they would use that to actually then target those places. And a third of their targets were civilian infrastructure. And they also targeted weddings. They targeted funerals. And so here, we had a chance in Congress to say that there is a resolution that was passed back in the days of Vietnam in 1973 called the War Powers Resolution. And it's a resolution that hadn't been used in all of these years until it's been picked up right now in Congress to say that war has never been declared in Yemen. The U.S. is actively involved in hostilities, although I will tell you there are many people in Congress who tried to say that refueling their airplanes and giving them logistical support did not mean we were involved in hostilities. But through the work of broad coalition of organizations, and anybody here have been working on that? Well, around the country, we've had a lot of people, not only the traditional peace groups, but also the humanitarian community, like Oxfam and Save the Children and Bread for the World and all of these groups. And we've been working actually with some conservative groups as well, and got to the point where once the House became in the hands of the Democrats, we were able to get the bill to the floor and to pass it last week. And that's very, very important. Now it's going to go to the Senate this upcoming week. We hope it's going to pass in the Senate. And then it will go onto the desk of the orange man in the White House. And we will see if that indeed becomes the first bill that he will veto, a bill to stop the U.S. from participating in the destruction of the country of Yemen. So it's positive that there is some energy in Congress to stop that war. But before I move on from our relationship with Saudi Arabia, I do want to say one other thing, which is the reason that the Crown Prince was touted as being a reformer was? Anybody? Why? Women were going to be allowed to drive. Now, let's talk about low bars, right? Because it was the only country in the world where women were not allowed to drive. So yes, he's going to let women drive, and he's such a reformer. Meanwhile, he takes the very women who had been working on that campaign, some of them for decades, and throws them in prison. And those women are in prison right now, and they're being tortured in prison right now. And they're being put in solitary confinement in prison right now. And these are the women who really should be heralded as the ones who fought and won, finally, the right to drive. And instead of doing that, the prince put them in prison. And can you understand why? Why? Right, exactly. He doesn't like what they did because he does not want advocacy in his country. Because advocacy is very dangerous if you are a dictator. And one other thing the women had started to do was to work to end the guardianship system, which is a system where a woman is treated as a minor her entire life. From the time you're born to the time you die, you have to have a man who acts as your guardian. And that man might be your father, it might then be your husband, and later in life it might be your son. But that man determines some of the most important things in your life, like if you can get married, who you're going to get married to, some jobs, if you can are going to get a passport, if you travel. So these women were working to get rid of the guardianship system, and he wanted to put a stop to that. Okay, we're going to give you the right to drive and don't ask for anything else. But most important is what you say. He doesn't want the example of people advocating and winning something to start spreading. And so we have this very perverse relationship with Saudi Arabia. Now, just this last week on Wednesday and Thursday, I don't know if you got any news about it because it was there wasn't a lot of coverage about it, but it was a meeting that happened in Warsaw, Poland, that the Trump administration put together, touting that they were going to bring together a coalition of countries from not just the Middle East, but farther afield to come together. And originally, they said it was to deal with Iran. How are we going to deal with Iran? But there was a lot of uproar of saying, wait. You know, there are many other problems in the Middle East. And so they broadened it and said it's about peace and security in the Middle East. So this meeting just took place on Wednesday and Thursday. But at one of the press conferences around the meeting, I think it was one of the CBS News people, she asked, how can you talk about the human rights abuses in Iran when you don't talk about them in Saudi Arabia? And this was to Mike Pence. And he kind of looked at her like, what? She had to repeat the question again. What? And he basically said, that's a ridiculous question. So it's not a ridiculous question. And for most of the world, they see through the tremendous hypocrisy of the United States of not questioning Saudi Arabia, of this tight embrace that the Trump administration has while it is going whole hog after Saudi Arabia's nemesis and Israel's nemesis, which is Iran. And so after I wrote the book, you know, I wrote the book on Saudi Arabia because I had been doing work on Israel and Palestine. I come from a Jewish family. They didn't like my work on Israel and Palestine. And they would always say to me, well, what about all these horrible Arab countries? Why don't you do something about them? And after hearing that for a number of years, I thought, well, maybe I should look into some of these Arab countries. And looked into Saudi Arabia and realized what a horrible government that was and wrote a book about it. But as I was writing a book about Saudi Arabia, then I realized you can't really talk about Saudi Arabia without talking about Iran. And so, and knowing that my government has its sights set on Iran as the place for a next war, I realized how important it was to get out and talk to people about Iran, because it's often said that that war is the way that Americans learn about geography. And it's important not to let that happen in the case of Iran. And has anybody here, are they either Iranian or American? Do we have any Iranian Americans here? Do we have any people here who have been to Iran? When were you there? Oh, a while back. And you?
1980s.
Uh-huh. So one of the things it's hard not to fall in love with Iran, right, when you're there. I mean, it's just a beautiful, beautiful country with an incredible history of about 2,500-year history and literature, architecture, poetry, Iranians who love their poets. You know, it's funny, they have different squares, and here in our squares in the U.S., it's usually some military guy who's on a horse with some, you know, weapon. But in a lot of the squares in Iran, you'll find the poets who are being heralded. And they also have going up to more modern times, a history of a relationship with the United States during the days in the 1900s of the Shah that was very close to the United States and close to the Western world and trying to, quote, modernize Iran. And it was during those days that the Shah of Iran gave the oil concessions to a British company that is today BP. And the British company was earning a lot of profits off Iranian oil, and Iranians were starting to question whether that made sense for them. And wouldn't it make more sense for them to nationalize their nation's oil and have the profits go for the people of Iran? Strange notion, but this was in the 1950s. And the Iranians then voted in somebody in power, became Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, with the mandate to nationalize Iran's oil. And he went about doing that to the horror of the British oil company. And the British government, who then went to the U.S. government and said, we can't allow that to this to happen. It's a terrible example, not just for Iran, but what about other countries with resources that we need? And we have to teach them a lesson. And that's when the U.S. CIA got involved in a coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. That is something that Iranians will never forget, because the history of Iran would be totally different if the U.S. had never overthrown that government. Most Iranians say there would never have been an Islamic Republic in Iran had not their democratically elected leader been overthrown. And that's so important for us to understand, because, you know, at the time that was considered a very successful coup by the CIA and the US government. In fact, it was so successful that they used it the next year to overthrow Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, used it in the Congo to overthrow Patrice Lumumba. Oh, you tried to use it, it tried but didn't succeed in the case of Cuba, but that was the first model of a covert CIA operation. But when you see what success then led to, it led to the Shah coming back in, cracking down on the population, creating a horrific intelligence network that spied and then arrested and tortured any dissenters. It also led to the Iranians becoming the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons. And it led to the movements to overthrow the Shah going underground or going out into the diaspora overseas. And so they continued to fight against the Shah. And when they were finally successful in 1979 in overthrowing the Shah, who was it that had the most power? It was the clerics, because the mosques were the only places where people could openly congregate. And so the Islamists then had the upper hand to shape the way that the revolution would be manifested. And that led to the Islamic Republic that continues today and just had its 40th anniversary last week. So you can imagine that the Islamic Revolution that overthrew the Shah was anti-US, very clearly, because of the US meddling in the affairs of Iran for all those years. And it was anti-Israel as well. It supported the Palestinian cause for many years. And it was a time when the US broke relations with the Iranian government, and over all those years, the last 40 years, those relations have been negative, with ups and downs over the years, crises coming up, some little improvements in relationships, but the never having diplomatic relations, and always some kind of sanctions on Iran, until the time of the Obama administration. And you know, I started out criticizing Democrats because oftentimes you see they're both war parties. And under Obama, he kept a lot of the wars going of the Bush administration. But his really one foreign policy achievement was the Iran nuclear deal. That negotiating of that deal that John Kerry negotiated was such a major shift in potentially in the Middle East. And when John Kerry talked about it, he talked about the Iran nuclear deal as being one then that would hopefully lead to talking to Iran about lots of other issues and working with Iran on how to solve some of the conflicts in the Middle East. Well, instead, when Trump was campaigning for president, he said, what a horrible thing the Iran nuclear deal was, worst deal ever, you know, I'm gonna rip that up, spit on it. And indeed, when he came into office, he ripped up the Iran nuclear deal. Now, he didn't rip up the nuclear deal, that's wrong. He withdrew the United States from the nuclear deal. Because it's important to recognize that this nuclear deal wasn't between just the United States and Iran. It's also between negotiated with France, Germany, the UK, Russia, and China. It was approved by the entire European Union. It was approved by the unanimously by the UN Security Council. But there was one fatal flaw of that deal, and it's not the things that Trump says, like it had a sunset clause to it. The fatal flaw of it, it was not a treaty. It did not get approved by the Senate because Obama didn't think he had the votes there. So it was an executive agreement, which meant that Trump could come in and do what he did, which was rip it up. Now, this is an agreement also to recognize that it was working. To this day now, it's been 13 times that the International Atomic Energy Association, the organization charged with monitoring the agreement, has said that Iran is in compliance. It's also to recognize how many nuclear weapons does Iran have? Okay, I want everybody to hear that. Can you say it loud? Zero. Iran has zero nuclear weapons. How many nuclear weapons does the country in the Middle East that was so against an Iran nuclear deal, it's called Israel. How many nuclear weapons does Israel have? You're a smart audience. We don't know. But we know they have them, of course. And some would say there's about 200 of them. But here you had Netanyahu with the gall to come before the U.S. Congress and say, we cannot trust the Iranians. This deal is not good enough, not tight enough. And yet, his country has nuclear weapons, will not allow any kind of inspectors to go in. It would be a joke to just to think about that, and has not joined any kind of treaty, the non-proliferation treaty. And yet they're the ones saying that the treaty with Iran was not good enough. And so when the Trump administration pulled out, it was doing the bidding of Bibi Netanyahu, and it was also put itself in conflict with the Chinese, the Russians, and the Europeans, because they want the deal to continue, and they are staying in the deal. Well, it's not just that the U.S. said, okay, we're not in this deal anymore. What it really means is then that the Trump administration reimposed sanctions. Now, these sanctions are really crippling sanctions. These sanctions don't just say, no U.S. companies can do deals with Iran. It says, any company anywhere in the world that wants any kind of business with the United States cannot do any deals with Iran. It's called extraterritorial sanctions. It's the height of imperial hubris to say that we will tell everybody around the world who they can and can't do business with. And unfortunately, because the dollar is still so strong and is the international financial currency, the U.S. government can do that. And so there are attempts, there are attempts to circumvent these sanctions, but it's very hard to do because the big companies like the European companies, Daimler, Boeing, Airbus, Total, Eni, the oil companies, they have already pulled out of Iran. And it has meant many billions of dollars of businesses that Iran is now not allowed to do. And what is happening, that it's constricting the currency that has lost about 80% of its value. It means that people are having a very difficult time feeding their families, getting medicines they need. And this is on purpose. The U.S. is doing this on purpose because it wants the Iranian people to so hate their government that they will rise up and overthrow the government. But the Iranian people, many of whom do not like their government, look around the region and say, uh-oh, we don't want to be like Syria. We don't want to be like Libya. We don't want to be like Iraq. And they think maybe we're better off doing reform from within than having some overthrow where there would just be chaos. And indeed, there would be chaos in Iran. And so our job now is to figure out how can we rein in the Trump administration from waging a new war with Iran. There are bills in Congress that we are working on that say that the U.S. doesn't have the right, that the Trump administration does not have the right to get militarily involved in a war with Iran. But more important than that is an initiative now to say that we want to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. And that is something that has just become, as of I think yesterday, the official position of the Democratic Party, thanks to a lot of work that people have been doing. We want to make that the official position of every single candidate who is running for president. And it is a way for us to say to the rest of the world that there are people in the United States who are disgusted by the Trump administration's attempts to strangle the Iranian people because, again, we want to get our hands on Iran's oil and gas and other resources. And so I want to end by just throwing out a couple of things that I hope we're going to have time for some discussion. One is to say that some of the things that kept repeating in my talk tonight was about how war is a big business. And our organization, Code Pink, and there's a sign-up sheet out there if any of you want to get on our mailing list, and we hope you do, or you can go home and just look up codepink.org and get on the list. And there is somebody here who wanted to start a local chapter of Code Pink. If you could raise your hand. If anybody would like to see you afterwards, that would be great. But we have started something called Divest from War, the War Machine campaign, working with Peace Action and a lot of other organizations. And it's to try to get our cities and our universities and our pension funds, just like the environmental movement has said, stop investing in big oil, we're saying stop investing in the weapons business. And we have been successful in getting a couple of dozen congresspeople to pledge that they won't take money from the war machine. The latest one was Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, which is very important because he is now a very powerful leader in the House, the leader of the Rules Committee. And he is setting the standard of saying it is a conflict of interest. If you're voting on this bloated Pentagon budget and you're taking money from the very companies that are benefiting from that, that seems to the American people like it would be a conflict of interest. So I know you have a new congresswoman here, and it would be good to push her to ask her to take the pledge to divest from the war machine. And finally, I think I want to end by reading some inspirational quotes around why the first and last efforts of our government should be diplomacy, 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 nonviolence, nonviolence, nonviolence. And one is the great Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, who said many, many years ago, "It is only when you see a mosquito landing on your testicles that you realize there is always a way to solve problems without using violence." And I'll end with one by Martin Luther King that maybe is a little more elegant. "Don't let anybody make you think God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. We must rise up and beat our swords into plowshares, and nations must not rise up against other nations. I don't know about you, but I ain't gonna study war no more." Thank you.
I had this question for a long time, and I found a lot of answers, but I don't believe all of this answer can give me to understand this situation. My question is, why do you believe United States support Israel blindly, completely blindly. I remember in 2008, in Obama and McCain election, actually McCain in the debate tried to say Obama will not be good for our relationship with Israel. So Obama took the mic and he said very strong statement. He said, the relationship between United States and Israel is above the conflict between Democratic and Republican. Why do you think that? I read many answers. For example, some people, they said religious reason, because the majority of United States are Protestant, and the Protestant, they think Jesus will come back when we convert the Jews in Israel. That is one answer, but I don't know. I see the politicians of the United States, they are not really religious, they are secular. So, economic, I would like, yes, let's answer. Some people, they said about economic, but I really see Israel need United States, not United States need Israel for economic reason. Some people, they said because United States need an arm, to have arm inside the Middle East. But actually, when the Iraq problem happened, America went by itself, didn't depend on Israel. Actually, they asked Israel, be quiet. Even if Saddam attacked you, don't reply. So why do you think the support, the American support to Israel is completely blind?
Thank you for that.
Well, it's so important, and I know we have some people from the newly created Jewish Voice for Peace here. And can you raise your hand if you're with that organization? Let's let you try to answer that one. The question is, why does the United States have this incredibly close relationship with Israel? Well, if does anybody want to answer that from one of the groups? I mean, I think it's a multifaceted answer. And it does have to do somewhat with religion. You know, these religious groups like the Christians United for Israel are extremely strong. We also know the new Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who just got herself in a lot of trouble when she mentioned the strong lobbying group of AIPAC and how they use the money that's associated with the Israel lobby to get the support in Congress, and there is a lot of truth to that. I go to Congress all the time. I oppose AIPAC 110%, but I have to applaud AIPAC for the kind of organizing that they do. It's really incredible. If you not if you win office, if you are even vaguely thinking, I think they can tell your dreams. If you're vaguely considering running for office, you'll get visited by somebody from AIPAC, and they will ask you, what's your position on Israel? They will make you fill out a questionnaire. In the congressional offices, they demand meetings. And they have relationships with every single member of Congress. So there is a very, very, very strong lobbying group in the United States for pro-Israel policies. There's also incredibly strong economic ties. The military-industrial complex is so embedded in the United States with Israel. There are companies that are joint companies, companies like Elbit that are Israeli but are so powerful here in the United States. The technology is shared. The intelligence is shared. It was originally the U.S. beachhead in the Middle East, and it continues to be that. And so I think it's a combination of economic factors, of religious factors, and of plain old, very good lobbying efforts that keep the U.S. so closely tied to the Israeli government.
Okay, next.
I think we are obviously in the very late stages of capitalism that is, by definition, expansionistic. And this, I guess my question is, long ago when I learned about the petrodollar and, you know, how the U.S. and the Saudi, you know, thing. We'll build great things for you, and you supply us oil. And so everything was traded in dollars, and you touched on that before. I had read along the ways, every time we would invade a country, Libya was one of them for sure, that part of the reason, not the whole reason, but part of the reason was they were starting to trade oil in something other than dollars. And that shall not be, you know, that's precedent setting. Then I heard Venezuela had actually been trading to China, going around U.S. dollar, but I didn't really focus on it enough to find out, you know, when and where. So I guess my question is, for economic questions, I had read at one time that if the dollar stopped being the reserve currency of the world, it would lose half of its value, kaput, because the countries that could trade in something else might just switch over and do that, and so they didn't need dollar reserves anymore because if they are importers, that's their primary reason for keeping U.S. dollars. How much of that is still, is that more muddled now and not so much of an issue, or do you think it's a huge driver?
Well, you know, this was a big question that I had when I was looking into the economic sanctions on Iran, that why couldn't these other companies set up their own systems and be trading with Iran, not with the dollar? And then you realize that any transaction internationally goes through this SWIFT system that is U.S. controlled and U.S. In U.S. dominations. And even if it goes a second through there, that is then that gives the U.S. the ability to control those transactions. So the Chinese have developed their own banks. The Chinese do trade not in dollars in some of their international trades, but it's mostly a kind of barter system. And that's the system that the Europeans just set up to try to circumvent the U.S. sanctions. It is an important example of trying to get out of the dollar system. And we'll see how it works. The financial experts are thinking that it's not going to work very well, that it will be for only small companies and medium-sized companies, but no large companies are going to use it because, again, of the threat that the United States has on them. So I think as we are moving into a more multipolar world, as China gets more and more powerful, there will have to be other ways, whether it's cryptocurrencies or whether it's through Chinese currency or whatever it is. There are going to have to be ways to circumvent the U.S. because Trump is making that more and more imperative for the rest of the world. When he has trade wars with China, when he has trade wars with Canada, when he has trade wars with the Europeans, and he has these economic extraterritorial sanctions, other countries are looking more and more at ways that they can get around the dollar.
Okay, before you ask your question, I just want to say what's going to happen. After we finish with question and answer, we're going to have a whole bunch of books to sell. They're her books. We have books on Iran and books on Saudi Arabia. And we really hope that if you already paid for one, you come and get it, and Medea will autograph it for you. And if you haven't gotten one, you can also get one. And we're going to be doing that in Conover, which is in the back, where we're also having wine, beer, non-alcoholic drinks, and some snacks. So we hope everybody comes and talks to each other, and we can further talk about how we're going to build a peace movement.
And the books are very readable. They're kind of like Iran for Dummies and Saudi Arabia for Dummies. Not that you're dummies, but, you know, it's the kind of like basic stuff, so important to read.
Okay, what's your question?
Yeah, I just kind of wonder if there can be a focus to educate the public that there's a government system and there's an economic system. I mean, can there be a focus to bring about a difference between the two and not get them like, oh, democracy, oh, capitalism, this is what we got to fight for and this is what we believe in? And I mean, can there be a focus to bring about an awareness in the American public that an economic system is not the same as a governmental system. I look at socialism as being economic and governmental, but can we bring about a focus for the American public to educate the American public that there is a difference between a government system and an economic system?
Well, I don't know if I agree that there is such a difference, because it depends on what the government is. If you have a government like we have in the U.S., which is mostly a government that is controlled by corporate interests because of things like Citizen United that allows so much money in our political system, then you have, you know, a government that is mostly working for the wealthy. And I think through Bernie Sanders' campaign and now some of the young, very dynamic congresspeople that we have, we're getting a taste of how a government could really work in the interests of the majority of the people. The fact that there is such a terrific public opinion now for the need for a Medicare for All system shows that we want a government that takes care of the health needs, not a government that is in benefit of insurance companies. I think it's a really exciting time to show that government can and should work for the economic benefit of the majority of people, because especially among young people now, we have a lot more interest in looking into things like, what is socialism? How would that benefit young people who are strapped with ridiculous amounts of college debt? So, you know, it is a time when people are questioning how can government be used as a vehicle to improve the well-being of the majority of people, not be for the wealthy elites.
Thanks for being here. Thanks for having this. I wanted to first add one more reason for why there is this unconditional support for Israel by the United States, and it's propaganda. I grew up, I'm an American Jew, and I grew up believing Israel was given to the people, to the Jewish people. It's in the Bible. And it was a response to the Holocaust. I was never taught that there were already people there who had to be displaced. That's not something that's taught to young Jews in Hebrew school. But also, even today, the propaganda is always, you always hear, Israel was just defending itself, no matter what happens, which is not true in so many documented cases. But the propaganda, which of course is funded by AIPAC, but also propagated throughout our media, is another reason. And I do have a quick question about Venezuela and what's happening now. Last week on NPR, I heard a story. NPR actually interviewed Venezuelans on the street, regular everyday Venezuelans, saying how terrible it is there, how they have to leave. Maybe I'll go to Germany and get a job. Maybe I'll go to Canada until things get better here. It's so repressive. There's no money. I mean, it was propaganda from NPR, which people believe is a liberal outlet, etc. So I think I know who's funding the Israeli propaganda. Who's funding the Venezuelan propaganda, and how does it get into the media so quickly?
Well, thank you for adding the propaganda side of things, but also, you know, propaganda is a one-sided view of things, and that's something that AIPAC does beautifully through its trips to Israel, and is another reason to add in there, because it takes thousands of people to Israel every year.
Kids.
It takes the student body presidents of 1,000 different schools, high schools. It takes leaders of the NAACP. It takes leaders from the Latinx community. It really gets itself into the heartland of the U.S. and takes them on one-sided trips to Israel. And then people see and talk to Israelis who say, this is the most marvelous thing, and we're only defending ourselves from the horrible Hamas. And they come back with a real, you know, sense of I love Israel. So there's that element to it as well. In the case of Venezuela, there are people in Venezuela who are going hungry, who are having a very difficult time, who hate their government. And so I think it's fine to be reporting that. But you have to also report the other side. You have to report the side that there were 6 million people who voted for Nicolas Maduro for president. There are millions of people who come out on the streets to support this government. And so we have to demand of NPR, which is very conservative when it comes to most foreign policy issues. Some people call it National Pentagon Radio. that we want to hear both sides. And I think their coverage of Venezuela has been horrible.
Yeah.
I've had the opportunity to watch you on TV and some of the hearings that you've been in. And my question is, how did you get in? And what happened when they drug you out?
So I was telling Judy that they change the rules all the time because of us. And now if you hold up a sign in a hearing, you will be arrested. If you speak out, you will be arrested, and that the penalty gets higher depending on how many times you've been arrested. So we have to get new blood. Because the first two times, and you get in by standing online, we get up really early, we stand online, we're the first ones there, and for your first two times, it's a $50 fine and that is it. Nothing. No record, no nothing. It was like a parking ticket. So any of you want to come to Washington, D.C., we'll put you up in the Code Pink House. You'll have a great time, and you too can go to one of these hearings and get arrested and pay like a parking ticket. But if you do it many times, it gets more difficult. So somebody had asked me outside, they said, I saw you in a picture at that hearing, but you looked a little strange. And I said, yeah, that's because if you have it on a T-shirt, you're okay. You can't hold up a sign, but you can have a T-shirt that says something. So we wrote these T-shirts that said, hands off Venezuela. But I'm kind of small, so you only saw the ands, not the hands, and you only saw the of, not the off. And so I was like, oh my goodness, this is terrible. I found a piece of cardboard in the hall, and I put the cardboard under my shirt so that it went out like this. But it looked like I had a, like, some rare disease or some but you could read perfectly, hands off Venezuela. And as we went in the hearing room, they're just looking at me and they said, oh, Medea, you know, what will you come up with next? But that was technically legal. So anyway, we do need more people to speak out at hearings. And it's a very cathartic kind of thing. So if you're feeling quite upset about what the government is doing, come to D.C. and come to a hearing.
So the new Kansas City chapter of Code Pink sounds like they too can sponsor tours to D.C.
We have an activist house in D.C. where people come for 3 days, 4 days a week at a time. And so it's free, and we take you on the hill. And, you know, you don't have to go up and yell and scream and get arrested. I mean, that's the fringe benefit. You can... You can come and just go dress nicely and go lobby with us, which we do a lot of that as well.
Medea, I just wanted to say thank you for coming to the heartland. You know, it's been said all wars are bankers' wars. And I was just curious if Code Pink has ever protested against some of the, you know, international big banks and the international system, which you referenced, the Bank for International Settlements, running through Switzerland, of which our private Federal Reserve is, you know, one of the key members. Have you ever protested them?
Yes, we protest the banks, we protest the investment companies. We've had a big campaign around BlackRock because they invest billions of dollars in the weapons industry. We've been following around the CEO of BlackRock everywhere he goes. We've protested his house, we protest when he goes to events. But you know, because money talks in this country, he gives a lot of money to all of these charitable things, and he was just awarded this year, for example, at the International Relief Committee, which does, you know, great work around the world. They gave him a humanitarian award. So we try to get into every places where they are speaking or being awarded to say, you know, this person is making a lot of money off of war. But you're right, it's the banks and the investment firms as well as the weapons companies. And just one thing on the weapons companies, 5 out of the 6 largest weapons companies are now run by women. And this has been touted as this great achievement, literally busting through the glass ceiling, because women are now the heads of these companies like Lockheed Martin. So we do think it's important that women say this is not what we aspire to.
Okay, looks like this is going to be the last question. If you have a question you've been holding up asking, better get in line.
Is there any essential moral difference between the worldwide empire of the government of the United States and other historic military empires such as the British Empire, Spanish Empire, the Turkish Empire, Roman Empire, Assyrian Empire, etc.? Is there any essential moral difference there? Thank you.
Well, I think you know, some of those empires maybe didn't pretend that they were doing this for altruistic reasons. ours is that we're this myth of being an exceptional country and everything we do is for the good. I mean, Trump makes it a lot more clear than other leaders have done, because he says it's only about America, and if we're going to go in somewhere, let's get the resources and get out of there. Like he said, Iraq, we should have just taken the oil. But the myth really is that we are a force for good. I think there's a lot of people in this country who believe that myth, that when the U.S. is going into places, it's to help the people of Venezuela or, you know, help the people of Iran. Fortunately, I think because we've been involved in endless wars now, people are getting tired of it. But if it is, I think we understand that empires come and go. All empires come and go. The U.S. will not be an empire for all that long. These 800-plus bases we have around the world are not going to stay forever. And even though, didn't Donald Trump say the other day, there will never be socialism in the United States, ever, 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 I think one day there might be. So maybe we'll just be one humble nation among others and live in peace with the rest of the world. Inshallah.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I feel like I'm so out of my league here. But I mean, Syria, I go back and I think about it, and I think about, you know, the Arab Spring Rising stuff, and people thinking that maybe they should get up, get rid of the president, and they started this genocide, you know, chemical warfare and bombing hospitals. I mean, it was unbelievable what was going on, that the government decided they were going to fight back. I'm sure you remember all that. I haven't heard you mention the Russians and anything. Kind of interested in their relationship and all this stuff. I guess that's part of why we're there. But, and then the issue of ISIS, you know, these people that have literally destroyed these countries, you haven't talked about them. So those are my curiosities.
So I would say Russia under Putin is trying to reclaim some of the largesse of the old Soviet Union and the influence, and is for the most part as guilty as the U.S. in terms of getting involved in other countries and bombing other countries and upholding dictators when it's in their interests. While the U.S. is the stronger country right now, the Russians are doing that. The Chinese are very different. The Chinese do it through economic means. You know, they don't go around showing their military might. They go around buying things up and taking people's resources and creating factories and that kind of thing. And, you know, eventually they are going to surpass the U.S. very quickly economically, and will probably be the next empire. And I certainly wouldn't trust the Chinese, given the lack of democracy that exists in China itself. But they are much smarter than the U.S. in terms of the way they exercise power around the world. And then the issue about ISIS. Let's recognize that ISIS came out of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Were it not for the U.S. invasion of Iraq, ISIS would not have existed. And the way that the U.S. is trying to impose its will on so much of the world creates the conditions for groups like ISIS that then are able to convince young men who can't get jobs, who don't have a future, that they have to join a group like ISIS to find their identity. So certainly, whether it's fighting the gang violence in Central America or groups like ISIS in the Middle East, it would be much healthier for the communities there as well as here to be working on ways to improve the economic situation in their countries, to give people a say in the way their governments run so they wouldn't have to join an armed group to try to overthrow governments. So that's why I think, because the Arab Spring turned out so badly. I mean, we have a friend from Egypt here who knows. You know, I was in Tahrir Square during the Arab Spring in Egypt, and I thought, this is the most glorious thing I've ever seen. And to see Egypt descend into another dictatorship today in so much of the Arab world, for many people in the Arab world right now, they are more interested in reforming their governments than in overthrowing them, because it just has not worked.
I just wanted to find out, there was a divestment movement against companies that basically do business and support the Israeli government. And there was a student movement that was very strong, but apparently that seems to have petered out. Do you know what happened with that? Or?
Well, it hasn't petered out, really. It's still quite a strong movement on campuses. The problem is that they have been attacked relentlessly, horrifically, by these right-wing pro-Israel groups that have singled people out individually, these students, and created something called, it's called the Canary Mission. And if you go on their website, I'm on it, even though I'm like, you know, way, way past being a student, like senior days, but it's mostly students. And it's the bios of them, and they hound these students. They try to get them in trouble on the campuses. They try to get the Students for Justice in Palestine groups disbanded. So there's been a very horrible attack on the student movement, but some of them are still out there.
Okay, you're the last one, except for me.
Okay, Karl Marx predicted that the capitalism will hang itself, will kill itself. Do you think that is what's happening now? Because, for example, for a long time, the politicians run the countries for the interest of the businessmen or for the capitalists. But now they decide, no, it is not enough for us. We will run the country by ourselves. And I think that's why the Republican Party vote for Trump. And do you think that is what's happening now in France? I mean, about the yellow fists. Do you think that is it will be the end of the capitalism? Or because after the collapse of Soviet Union, Michel Fukuyama predicted that's the end of the history.
The 50s,
so the
right.
Liberalism to be the end. But actually, it doesn't seem it is the end. And we will have another stage. Do you think what happened in France now is just the beginning? And I say France because actually the liberalism started in France with the revolution. So what happened in France, I think it is very, very important. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a phenomena that we don't know where it's going. You know, the Yellow Vest movement is very contradictory, and are people from different ideological sides that are coming out to participate in that, and it's, you know, an anti-government, anti-capitalist system that is screwing the workers in France, who were used to a much better system, much better pensions, much better social safety net, but unfortunately some of those in the Yellow Vest are also anti-immigrant or white nationalists. And so you're seeing that things can go many different ways right now. We're seeing this. We're seeing this in our own country with people electing Trump as part of their rebellion against the system. So we don't know how it's going to go. But I think one thing we do know is that it is a time where we need more experimentation. That Fukuyama was totally wrong. It wasn't the end of history. That there are different examples of social democracies, particularly in the Scandinavian countries, that. Many people in this country would like to see that Bernie Sanders just ignited such enthusiasm around a totally different kind of system and proudly calls himself a socialist. And when you see that the majority of young people in this country have a more favorable view of socialism than of capitalism. So I think our system is in a time, and our world is in a time of upheaval and evolution. And hopefully that evolution will be towards a different kind of system. And I think that, you know, capitalism, we've seen that it's able to morph and to hold on and to recreate itself in so many different forms. But I do think that during this presidential election, we're going to see some really exciting times where people are going to be educated by different candidates with different views. And I also want to say that there is a generational thing happening in Congress right now. It's the same system, but it's a different system, and you feel it when you get people like Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar. These are just a handful of young women, and they have revolutionized things within Congress already, and you can feel it. And they are embarrassing the hell out of the old timers who are like, we want the status quo. So whether it's around the Green New Deal, or whether it's around Medicare for All, or whether it's around a new peace deal, it is the time when people who are in positions of power are thinking boldly, are exciting young people, and are making us feel like maybe it is the time for a significant structural change in the United States, and I think we're going to get it. Thank you.
I have a question. Medea, I have a question. Oh, I get to ask a question. Yeah. And this is brief. You mentioned to me that there's a bill in Congress to try to stop Trump on Venezuela. Could you talk about that and what people can do?
So there are two bills. One is just a letter, and the letter was to the Secretary of State saying how the economic sanctions are hurting the ordinary Venezuelan people, and if we don't want to hurt them, we should lift those economic sanctions. And it also says that there is a way out of that, and this is through negotiations, that Mexico and Venezuela and the Vatican have all put themselves forward to be mediators, and we should be supporting their efforts at mediation. So there's that letter introduced by Rokana.
And other members of Congress can sign it, right?
Yes. And so then the other one, which is perhaps more enduring because it's a bill rather than a letter, and that is introduced by David Cicilline from Rhode Island. And it says what the Constitution says, which is the president does not have the right to use military force against another country, in this case Venezuela, without it going through Congress. And that is a very important bill that we really need every member that we can get in Congress to sign on to.
Right. So whether you live in Kansas or Missouri, you know who to contact. Okay?
The bill is HR 1004 is the number of the bill. And there's a way, if you ever want to see a bill, you just go online and you type in Thomas, like the name Thomas.gov, and then you just put in whatever, Venezuela, Iran, Iraq, whatever it is, and the bill will pop up. And the first one that will pop up there is 1004. It's a very short, very good, short bill. It does the requisite, Maduro is a horrible dictator, we hate him, we wish he would disappear, but kind of thing. That's what they feel they have to do. But it's a good bill.
Okay, so thank you so much.
Thank you.